You're listening to the KunzerCast featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of Too Much Magic, The Long Emergency, and The World Made by Hand novels.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning into my podcast, the Kunstler Cast. It's great to be here, or as Keith Richards observed many times, it's great to be anywhere, because about a week ago, I almost wasn't anywhere after having an interesting medical misadventure, going into the hospital for a cervical vertebrae surgery that went awry and led to a coronary bypass operation about a week ago. And if you want to read about the details, it's on my Monday blog over at Clusterfuck Nation in the usual place on Kunstler.com. I'm really on the kind of the shady side of that now and feeling a lot better, walking around, taking long strolls and going shopping and sitting at my desk doing regular work, getting back to writing World Made by Hand 3. And all that. I've got a nice zipper kind of scar on my chest along with three Frankenstein drain holes from where the hoses came out of my body for about 3 days. And that's kind of interesting. But the main thing I'm anticipating now is the racketeering phase of my medical journey, where the Albany Medical Center comes at me with the bills. You know, the whole time I was in the hospital, every time a nurse or some practitioner of some kind came around to do something to me, they all had this scanner in their hands, and they all scanned the little barcode that was on my patient bracelet. So I figure, you know, every time they scanned it, giving me a blood thinner shot or taking my blood pressure or, you know, taking my pulse or doing whatever else they were doing, that they were racking up, you know, incredible charges with each one. So we'll see how that works out. What I would be interested in is if any of you listeners out there know something about forensic accounting, you know, about people who will help you battling absurd medical charges, give me a holler at my regular email, jhkunstler@mac.com. But if you want to read about the details about it, just go to the website and read the blog. I don't want to talk about it anymore today. Today, I'm going to be playing an interview that I did with the author and farmer, Ben Hewitt, of Cabot, Vermont, the author of the books The Town That Food Saved, which came out a couple of years ago, about Hardwick, Vermont, and his new book, Saved, which is about how he quit worrying about money and became the richest guy in the world.
Ben, it's nice to be with you. Nice to talk to you over the phone here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks, Jim.
I've been enjoying your books, The Town That Food Saved.
Yeah,
when did that come out?
That came out, June of 2010.
And the subtitle is How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food.
That's correct.
And tell us a bit about that town.
Yeah, so the town in question is the town of Hardwick, Vermont, which is about 8 miles to the west of me. I live in Cabot, Vermont. So both Cabot and Hardwick are right on the sort of southern fringe of what is called the Northeast Kingdom. So it's Vermont's sort of most remote Northeast corridor. You know, Hardwick is a town of about 3,200 people, and it's a town that's for a long time sort of really struggled to find sort of economic vitality. It was a booming center of granite trade in the early 1900s, but the advent of reinforced concrete really basically caused an implosion in the granite industry in very, very short order, which was that was in the 1920s. 20s, which was then, of course, followed by the Great Depression. So the town has ever since then sort of had a tough time sort of finding, sort of a viable economic platform. And so it was sort of against that backdrop, and I grew up not in Hardwick, but on the periphery of Hardwick. I was born in northern Vermont in St. Albans, and then my folks moved down to just outside of Montpelier, which is not far from Hardwick. So I always had this awareness of this town as sort of being this kind of tough, hardscrabble, I guess is the sort of almost cliched term for it.
By the way, you can say the same thing about dozens and dozens of the towns up in the Northeast here. We're surrounded by them.
Not just the Northeast. I mean, this is, I think this is a representation in broadly speaking, of rural America.
Quite so.
Hardwick certainly does not, is in some ways not a special case, and in a lot of ways.
So how did it rescue itself?
Well, what I became intrigued by was in about 2005, 2006, I just started noticing, first of all, it's probably important to note that my wife and I operate a small farm, and we have a really sort of a hyper-diversified little hill farm here on 40 acres. And so I had this sort of interest in small-scale agriculture and, I call it so-called sustainable agriculture.
As well as being a professional freelance writer.
Right, and a writer, right. And so, there's these two aspects of my life, that sort of are witnessing what I'm seeing going on in about 2005, 2006, which is this sort of explosion in small-scale food-based enterprise in Hardwick. And so, so there's one aspect, the sort of agricultural aspect of me, that's thinking, wow, that's really cool, that's really neat. And then there's the sort of writer aspect of thinking, well, this is just like, about the last thing I would have expected in Hardwick, and I'm finding this really, really curious and interesting. And the reason I say that, of course, is because, there has been sort of this, fermenting awareness of local food and sustainable ag. But my perception, having grown up in, blue-collar rural Vermont, is that this is really something that is going to at first take root in more affluent communities. And the idea that this is happening in a community where the median income is less than $15,000 and the unemployment rate is 40% higher than the Vermont state average, it's just fascinating to me.
But you can, in Hardwick and the surrounding towns, you can export those products and the value-added products to a range of other places reasonably close that are more affluent.
Of course, yeah, exactly. And this is, you're getting at some of the sort of dynamics I really wanted to look at, because at the same time, I'm seeing all this stuff happening, I'm hearing all these conversations among some of these, sort of entrepreneurs, I sort of termed them agripreneurs, and I knew some of these people, at least peripherally, and I'm hearing all these conversations about how they're going to sort of blueprint a healthy food system and, sort of show people what a small-scale, regionalized, healthy food system looks like. And so there was part of me that wanted to sort of explore that dynamic. At the same time, sort of noticing that a lot of these businesses are these value-added businesses that are making these really, really, sort of high-end artisanal products, and the vast majority of which is getting shipped beyond the town lines. And there's a part of me that's just, with all this conversation about local food sort of emerging and sort of, percolating in the American consciousness, there was a part of me that really wanted to sort of try to explore the ramifications of this. And what does it really mean? I mean, you say, oh, local food system and local food, and it all sounds great. I think there are very few people who say that that's, not a great, not... That's a good way to direction to be going, but what does that really look like, and what are the circumstances that compel these businesses to have to create these really high end products and ship them beyond town lines?
Well, one thing I wonder is, would you describe the situation in Hardwick these days as having achieved some kind of a critical mass of activity that might be called economic takeoff, or is it less than that, or is it heading towards that, or what?
I would say it is. I would say there is a critical mass of activity, and I would say that there is takeoff. I guess the question I have that still you know, sort of is pinging around in my head as I look at what's going on is, you know, to what extent is this economic activity sort of predicated on, you know, maintaining the status quo in terms of, you know, sort of the broader economy? In other words, you know, if you are a high-end artisanal food producer anywhere, or Hardwick or anywhere, you know, is it, you know, do you have the highest level of resilience when your primary consumers, customers, are in New York City or San Francisco, and you're sort of relying on them to pay, you know, $25 for a pound of cheese or whatever it is?
Well, you know, it all kind of depends on how things shake out.
Exactly.
As you may know, I'm kind of interested in the idea of a world made by hand economy, but you know that assumes that that some of the existing alternatives are no longer there, like being able to go to the Grand Union supermarket and you know, get cheese for $3 instead of paying, you know, more.
Yes, yeah, and you know I want to point out that I'm not sort of asking these questions to sort of denigrate these efforts. I think that these are an important part of, you know, the economic landscape wherever they're happening. It's just interesting to me to consider to what extent these sort of represent, you know, what we might consider a truly sort of sustainable, you know, quote unquote sustainable, healthy, whatever you want to call it, the, you know, localized food system.
How special was Hardwick economically or culturally? Was it a lucky town that was able to do this? Because there are an awful lot of other small places in Vermont and upstate New York that haven't been able to get this
together. Yeah, I would say there was, I mean, I think there was, you know, I get to ask this question a lot, and I think there were numerous factors, you know, and it was sort of, originally I sort of thought it was, I guess, you know, almost ironic, you know, that this was happening in a town that was, you know, had sort of had economic, sort of a stagnant economic environment. But more and more I sort of see it as being almost, you know, the natural outgrowth of a town where there hadn't been necessarily a tremendous amount of economic opportunity, but there was a real base of sort of, you know, intellectual property around sort of agriculture and small-scale agriculture. So this is a town and a region that had not really severed its ties to small-scale agriculture as thoroughly as most regions in this country have.
Right? Are you implying also that the people there maybe, you know, were people who could read books or were culturally in some way a little bit above the...
I'm not really implying that at all. I mean, I think there's a, you know, like most rural communities, I think there's a real sort of cross-section of people who, you know, might read and be interested in reading books and some that aren't.
So it didn't have to do with high culture necessarily.
No, I don't think it had so much to do with high culture as, I guess I would say, an agricultural ethos that was still somewhat intact, if that makes any sense. I think it also had to do with the fact that it was a region that had been, you know, for the most part, unimpacted by the housing and real estate boom, so that there was still a lot of affordable land in the area.
Also kind of unaffected by the suburban sprawl problem.
Exactly,
because you're so far from Boston and New York.
Right. And I think another thing that it would be a mistake to overlook is that, you know, even though the town and the area, I think, is, and I think this is true of a lot of rural American communities, even though they might be economically challenged, they are in some ways, you know, communally enriched, in the sense that there is still a degree of interconnectedness and sort of, and when I say self-reliance, I don't mean, you know, individual people. I mean a sort of community-wide self-reliance.
Well, you know, it makes me wonder, though, what is the cultural infrastructure where that can happen? I mean, does it come? Where do people meet and spend time to allow that to happen?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. And I, you know, what I observed in this area, well, you know, we're really getting into the meat of this book, I think, which in some ways was what I observed was almost two versions of a local food system. And one version was the version that was sort of being trumpeted and by this sort of group of agripreneurs, which were these, you know, relatively young, mostly 30-something, mostly men, all relatively well-off, people starting these businesses, and they would meet on a regular basis. They were all friends of one another, and they would meet on a regular basis to sort of talk about how they could work cooperatively, or what they could do to sort of further their enterprises. And at the same time, and one of the reasons I was really interested in writing the book was because I was also really interested in some of the sort of quieter, I guess I would call them quieter, sort of a longer-term, small-scale agricultural enterprises, operations in the area that weren't really getting all that much attention. And I was sort of interested to see how these two either, worked cooperatively or did not work cooperatively, and what each of their impacts was on the community.
Uh-huh. Well, that whole endeavor led you to a further consideration of the nature of the economy that we're in, and
yes,
to your forthcoming book, which is titled Saved.
Yes.
How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World.
Right. Yes.
And I want to talk to you about that economy, because, it has, I think it is certainly something that I've been preoccupied with. You call the current economy of consumerism and money grubbing and hyper acquisitiveness the unconscious economy.
Right.
Okay, explain.
Well, I mean that on a lot of different levels, and I guess probably most visceral to me is the fact that the unconscious economy, the economy that most of us, even myself, to a large extent, are sort of beholden to, is an economy that externalizes, the true costs of production, and of course of disposal. So it's an economy, where we are largely unconscious. I think sometimes by choice, sometimes out of sheer ignorance, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way. Again, I just mean that we are not really offered very many windows through which we can sort of become conscious to the ramifications of this economy.
Yeah, let's not forget inertia also.
And simple inertia. That's right. And listen, we've all grown up in an era where we have been repeated the messaging. It's all about remaining unconscious. There is no form of industry that wants us to be anything but unconscious in regards to our relationship to the economy.
Certainly in the sense that it's better for them if we're merely programmed and conditioned rather than thinking about what we're doing.
That's correct. Yes. And so, I think there's this real level, both on a, and again, as we were talking a little bit before, I think you started recording about, my view is almost always to sort of bring this to my personal relationship to these issues. That's, I guess, what I find sort of most interesting. Maybe it's a little self-centered, but that's what my perspective is. So I think this unconsciousness sort of exists on an individual level, and it also exists on a sort of more cultural societal level.
Well, that unconscious economy is cracking up now, actually. And
in a lot of ways it is.
It has become in some ways a lot worse very quickly over the last, decade. It's become more unconscious. It's become more abstract. It's become more virtual as the money system itself spins into criticality.
Right. Yes, I don't argue with that at all. I think you're absolutely right.
And where does that take us?
Well, that's a great question. Where does that take us? I mean, I don't think anyone who is familiar with your work and is listening to this is probably going to disagree with the fact that, clearly we are operating with a financial system, money system, economic system that is doomed. There's absolutely no question about that in my mind. Where I do have a lot of questions, and I'll tell you right up front, I spent most of 2008, 2009, and part of 2010, just assuming that at any minute the shit was going to hit the fan in a catastrophic way, right?
Mm-hmm.
After the sort of, papering over of the financial crisis, et cetera, et cetera. This is all terrain I'm sure you've covered, and we don't need to go there. I was enormously surprised, you know, to sort of find that they've been, you know, the powers that be or whomever it is has been able to keep the game afloat this long. So we're now into 2013. I well understand that the situation is not very good out there, and yet we have not really seen that crack up that I think a lot of us really expected.
Well, I think that we underestimated the power of sheer accounting fraud.
That very well
and wishfulness, you know, the combination,
right.
The combination of the wish to keep driving to Walmart forever,
right,
and the use of accounting fraud and the misrepresentation of just about every important marker of real accumulated wealth and the disposition of it, you know,
absolutely,
it's a very powerful thing.
It's incredibly powerful. I mean, it is just that sort of sheer inertia that, you know, we spoke of, you know, I think again before you started recording, but there is this tremendous inertia, you know, sort of pushing us to sort of toe the status quo line. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is that in, you know, I no longer in my personal life really spend a whole lot of time thinking about sort of when this whole thing comes down. You know, I think I know it happens. You know it happens.
Mm-hmm.
When it happens, I have no freaking idea anymore. And I don't even, I'm not even sure. In fact, I'm pretty much certain that it's entirely counterproductive to me for me to spend a lot of time sort of trying to figure that out. I think, you know, I think that there are forces at play that are, that, you know, we clearly have already underestimated. And it's really hard to understand, you know, to what extent they might continue to be able to sort of keep kicking the can.
Yeah, but you've already taken many of the critical actions that might put you in
point.
A position to, you know,
yes,
to,
and
to
I
thrive.
Want to acknowledge that. I want to acknowledge that because there's a part of me in the book, and I don't know if you've actually read the whole book, but I do struggle with that a little bit, Jim, because I made choices. My wife and I made choices before we knew we were making choices, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, we bought land in 1997. You know, we bought 40 acres of land for $30,000. We had saved $15,000. We borrowed the rest. We paid that off. We borrowed $10,000 from a friend and built a little, you know, my euphemism is, you know, it's a hippie shack that we mm-hmm. lived in. And paid that off, and then took out a very modest construction loan and built our own house, and then paid that off. So I'm here, sitting here, you know, talking about how I don't worry about money when I'm sitting on my little sort of 40-acre homestead, you know, I'm debt-free, and I have the tremendous luxury of, you know, not having to sort of spend my days punching a clock in order to pay the piper. You know, so I really want to acknowledge my tremendously privileged position,
mm-hmm.
and it's not a, you know, not really an economically privileged position. I don't make very much money. We don't have very much money. You know, I'm a writer, and I'm not.
And in your book, you state right out what your income has been.
That's
for
right.
Several
you know,
years.
Yes, and I'm. I
it's about as much as a junior high school janitor, or maybe actually quite a bit
yeah,
less.
Right. I know. I mean, you know, there are times when I'm like, you know, maybe I should be, you know, should really consider something else. But this is what I know how to do. I'm very happy doing this. And, you know, because we, you know, had the sort of good fortune of, you know, I think part of it was good timing. Part of it was just sort of, you know, I talk a little bit about my family's financial history in the book and why I think I've sort of, you know, always had this almost, I think, inherited innate distaste of debt. You know, so I've had, you know, we don't need a lot of money. And part of my interest in sort of writing the book was, you know, to explore, you know, sort of the mechanics of, as you know, another, you know, in addition to sort of myself being one of the primary characters in the book, there's this, my friend Eric.
Yeah, Eric Gillard. I wanted to ask you about him. He's a
yeah.
kind of a Henry Thoreau-like figure that you encountered,
right.
and then you ended up spending a lot of time with him,
yeah.
Kind of fascinated by the way that he has been creating his life. A 28-year-old guy who lives on almost no real money and has very little participation in the regular economic system.
Exactly.
So Eric, tell us about him.
Yeah, so Eric is this guy that we got to know through some mentoring programs with our children who are very interested in primitive skills and wilderness experiences, and Eric is kind of what he does. And he's a young fellow. When I first met him, he was single. He now has a pretty serious girlfriend that he actually lives with. But when I first, you know, when I first met him and sort of became familiar with his circumstances, you know, he was living on about $6,000 a year. And, you know, I was sort of fascinated by this for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons I was really interested in Eric and found him so compelling is that he is so clearly one of, I mean, it's such a cliche, you know, money doesn't buy happiness, right? But here's a guy who was so clearly one of the most content, sort of grounded, articulate, and in a lot of ways just wealthy people I'd ever met. I mean, he's just one of those people that is really, I mean, if you don't love this guy, you're just an asshole.
But he wasn't highly ideological about what he was doing. He was simply following a path that gave him some purpose and joy in being alive.
Yeah, and I really, you know, I think at the outset of the book and at sort of the outset of sort of examining his relationship to money a little more carefully, you know, I had this assumption that he was sort of eschewing money as you know, and it's sort of pushing it away and sort of that a relationship to money was the result of a negative. In other words, that I don't want this in my life. But what I have sort of, I think, come to understand that his relationship to money is almost exactly the opposite. It comes out of him embracing what is truly important to him. And so that, you know, as the more he embraces that and the more he sort of immerses himself in the beauty of his community, in his natural surroundings, in the things that are truly important to him, the less he needs money, the less interested he is in money. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I mean, it just becomes clearer, and I see this in my own life, you know, it just becomes clearer and clearer what a poor representation of true wealth money actually is.
You referenced Charles Eisenstein in the book, and
yeah.
He's a guy who has popularized a notion called the gift economy.
Right.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, since Charles isn't here?
Yeah, have you read Charles's book? Sacred
I'm familiar with him. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was a book that had I read it when I was about 2/3 of the way through writing Saved, and there was a real part of me that sort of felt like, man, I got to go back and start rewriting this book because it was a book that, you know, Charles has a real, you know, speaking of gift, he's got a real gift for articulating things that. At least in my life, and I think this is true for a lot of people because I see how Charles connects with people. I just got back from a conference where we were both speaking, and it was just such a great experience to sort of see him connect with people at the conference and to just have time to talk with him myself. And he's got this amazing gift, I think, for articulating things that people sort of know to be true in their hearts and minds but have a hard time themselves articulating. And so there were so many things. I'm reading this book, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's it. I get it. And one of the things he really talks about is the nature of the gift and how, you know, sort of having commoditized so many aspects of our well-being, we have kind of distanced ourselves from this idea of the gift, which is basically, you know, in some cultures and in some, and there has, you know, wealth is expressed through what you give. And your social standing is really proportional to what you give away, not what you accumulate. And of course, the way we do money in this economy, it really sort of forces us in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, there is another system that does operate even in the, you know, the hyper abstract money economy of today. Tom Wolfe has referenced it a number of times. He calls it the favor bank.
Interesting.
And
yeah,
it's,
I'm
you know,
not familiar with that term, but yeah.
It's really kind of just you know, a network of obligations and interchanges between people in which it's perhaps not consciously expressed, but
right.
You know, it's understood that you do something for me and something will be done for you at some point.
Exactly.
It actually functions, you know, I think, much more consciously in things like politics where it's obvious.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, and less obvious in things like, you know, manufacturing and accounting and, you know, writing
yeah.
books and stuff.
Yeah. And, you know,
but we all do it.
Right, we do. You're totally right. And it was one of my, one of my great interests in sort of exploring Eric's life was sort of looking at just sort of the mechanics of, you know, how does this work?
How did it work for him?
Well, yeah, excuse me. It's a great question. And, you know, it worked. I mean, there's a lot of different factors. And one of the things so clearly there is this sort of resetting of expectations, right? I mean, one of the things that the contemporary money economy has done for most of us is made us very, very wealthy in sort of these, these homogenized trinkets and goods. So, you know, we all have access to iPhones and laptops and all of this, you know, internet and all of this stuff that is, you know, by and large, you know, all the same. But at the same time, I think it really is depriving us as we sort of monetize more and more of our relationships with our fellow humans and community members. It also deprives us of those sort of deeper interpersonal relationships.
Well, I have an interesting experience with it here because I live in a small town, an old factory village, and about 15 miles from Saratoga. And the town is really quite dead.
Right.
You know, there's nothing going on in the main street, no businesses, nothing going on at night especially. But notably, really no gathering places for people, you know, to spend time with each other. And as it happens, that's all been commoditized in the form of television. You know, that's the public realm of America. And, you know, they've successfully exterminated the real public realm. And yet...
Right.
You know, the one night of the week that I really, in a conscious way, spend time with other people is, for example, tonight, Tuesday nights. You know, I play with I practice with a contra dance band in the adjoining town of Cambridge.
Right.
And it's such a wonderful experience to be able to spend time with other people in a purposeful and joyful way.
Right.
You know, we have a potluck dinner after the practice, which goes on for about 2 hours.
Right.
And, you know, I feel so fortunate that I have that to go to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in other cultures and in other times of human history, you would have that every night. Or you would have it in your own household, living in a household with more than one other person.
Right.
You know.
And this is one of the tremendous sort of, I'm not a technophobe. I use all of these technologies, but this is what to me is sort of one of the tragedies of our sort of reliance on, and I guess, you know, we've sort of placed this incredible deep-seated faith. What's the name of your new book? Too Much Magic, right? I mean, we have this tremendous sort of, like, faith that somehow these technologies are going to sort of all lift us up. You know, I had this conversation with someone just the other day, and they were just talking about, like, you know, the idea that, you know, that there was going to be this we were going to basically exterminate poverty through technology and through access technology.
Yeah, I want to smack people like that in the head when I hear it.
Oh, and it's infuriating to me. And all these promises that technology is somehow going to, you know, we're sort of getting off on a tangent here, but it's somehow going to, like, free us to live the lives we truly want to live.
Well, this has been an important theme for me lately, is that I think the American public is going to be hugely, deeply, and awfully disappointed by the broken promises of technology when they discover what kind of an economic world we're really heading into.
I absolutely agree. I mean, you can already see that promise being broken. And let me just give you, so here's this promise that all this amazing technology, talking cell phones and mobile...
Driverless cars.
Yeah. That's somehow going to, like, free us to lead these really sort of connected, wonderful lives that we all want to live. Well, how the hell do you think people are spending all of their new free time?
Doing email.
You got it! And getting on Facebook, right? In 2010, the average American watched 34 hours of television each week, and the average American child spent 53 hours per week staring into a screen of some form.
Yeah, what you're describing really is the diminishing returns of technology, and the main manifestation of it is a giant time suck.
Exactly. So yeah, here's all this, you know, so-called free time to do all this wonderful thing, and how do we choose to spend it? By,
Well, it's tragic. Ben, life is tragic.
Yeah.
And by that, I don't mean that everything is an unhappy ending. I mean that, you know, there are consequences to the things that we do, and there are an awful lot of unintended consequences that we have to contend with.
Right. Yeah. No, I, you know, I'm in full agreement of that. So, anyway, I don't even remember where we were. We were just sort of talking about this, you know, the community.
The absence of community, together. Really, yeah, the destruction of community.
And I look at all of these, you know, social media platforms, and what I see, and I realize that to some people, and I have a website and I have a blog, and I do some of this, and I get something out of it. I don't do it, you know, strictly because I'm not being sort of calculating and trying to market myself. There's a part of me that really appreciates that connection. At the same time, what I see, my view of these social media platforms is that they are, by and large, having you know, basically commoditized every other aspect of our lives. You know, one of the last things left to commoditize is our relationships with one another.
Exactly.
And I believe that they are, by and large, an attempt to commoditize those relationships. You know, we've commoditized, you know, energy, we've commoditized food, we've commoditized housing and shelter, we've commoditized pretty much everything. You know, in the sense that the air is unfit to breathe, we've commoditized the air, in the sense that, you know, groundwater is now being polluted by, you know, fracking chemicals. We've commoditized water because now, of course, you're going to have to buy bottled water so you don't get desperately ill. You know, all of the aspects of our well-being have pretty much been successfully commoditized, and I think, you know, we are running out of things to have commoditized for us, and I suspect that these relationships, the relationships that we have and the connections we have with one another, are one of the last things to go.
Well, a funny aspect of this for me is the assumption by an awful lot of people that the internet is a permanent presence in our lives, mm-hmm. and these are people who don't seem to be at all aware that it depends on an absolutely reliable electric grid.
Right, sure. I mean, which as you know, is
it's something that's not likely to persist forever.
No, it's a dangerous assumption. I mean, I think, you know, and this is particularly true in the Northeast. The Northeastern electrical grid is actually one of the most vulnerable grids in the country. That said, I think there will be great lengths gone. You know, keeping the lights on is, I suspect, a priority.
Oh, sure. I think that I agree with you. But let's turn to the issue of money.
Sure.
And what its role may be when our economy does have to reset and become less hyper-complex and less abstract. And
right.
I have to add at this point, I am not among the people who think that we can necessarily do without a medium of exchange.
Yes.
Which is another way of saying money.
Right.
And I get letters from people every week who said, oh, you know, if we only abolish money, everything will be great.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen myself.
No, and I'm not even sure that money is problematic, you know. I think what is problematic, I think the way we create money is problematic. You know, money, of course, is debt.
Yes.
That's how money is created. You know, the expectation that accumulated money will bear interest is problematic.
Well, it's problematic, especially if you're in a situation like ours where we face a declining set of energy inputs into that economy, which means a declining ability to generate industrial wealth.
That's right. That's entirely correct. But I don't know. I mean, my view of money, you know, I mean, it's a little, I write a book and the book is written and finished and I can't stop thinking about these things. So my ideas are still sort of evolving, you
mm-hmm.
know? And so I will tell you that this is what my view is right now. And it's not so much that money itself is problematic. I think what is problematic is our intention for money. You know, and our view of money as being an end unto itself rather than simply a means to an end, or one of, I guess another way to put it is, in my mind, a healthy relationship to money would be the view that money is just one of many tools that we can use to get the essentials and sometimes the non-essentials that we need to live fulfilling lives.
Well, yeah, I use the word purposeful,
mm-hmm.
and I think what has happened is that, you know, acquiring money has become a substitute for a purposeful life.
I don't disagree with that at all.
And certainly, you know,
exactly right.
just the practicalities of how we live in America, especially where, you know, the places that we live in America are demoralizing and dispiriting suburban wastelands for the most part.
Right.
And, you know, we think we can do without places to live in that are worth living in. And clearly that's not true. You know, clearly that detracts from a fulfilling and purposeful life. And yet, you know, just the sheer commodification of everything has led to that outcome.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it would be crazy to believe that that does not have an impact on our psyche. I mean, I think it has it's tremendously damaging to us as, you know, sort of whether you consider yourself a spiritual being or not, it in some way is damaging, you know, it's damaging at the very core of what it means to be human, you know. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, what has your personal journey been, as they say in the yoga classes?
Yeah, so my personal journey has been, you know, that I have, and I talk about this in a book a lot, about how, you know, despite the fact, and I think this is true for a lot of people, I know this is true for a lot of people, you know, I've never been sort of quote-unquote wealthy, at least, as you know, in monetary terms. And yet, I've also never gone without. You know, I have always been well-fed, well-clothed, well-sheltered. I've been warm in the winter.
Never been a war refugee?
Exactly, no. And, you know, it's like I've never spent a night outside except by choice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is true of most Americans. And, I think it's really important to acknowledge that, of course, there are a lot of people out there who do not have the luxury of saying these things. And so I just, you know, I feel really strongly we need to acknowledge that. But for myself, and probably for the bulk of people who are going to read this book, you know, that has not been the case. We have always had, you know, some sense of security regarding, you know, our short and medium-term futures. And at the same time, you know, despite this sort of sense of security, you know, I have allowed, at times in my life, I have allowed, you know, sort of money and concerns over money to dominate my consciousness, to be something that is just sort of this omnipresent force in my life. And I see, you know, my journey has been that, you know, the more aware I have become of, you know, how money works, what it is, what a poor representation of wealth it really is, how it sort of fragments us as individuals and I think as communities, the more I've become aware of that, the more I have been able to sort of distance myself from those concerns. And the more I have come to sort of view, you know, instead of sort of viewing the world as this sort of stingy place of scarcity, I really have this sort of view now that has evolved over the last few years of the world being a place where there is a certain amount of abundance. It's not the abundance of technology and that bullshit, you know, it's an abundance of the sort of the natural world. And, you know, the tragic reality is, Jim, I think, that the way the way we do money and the accumulation of monetary wealth has led, what it does is it leads, as we monetize all of these aspects of our lives, it leads to a sort of perception of scarcity, right? So as something enters into the sort of monetary realm, we begin to see that as something that's, oh, you know, that has a price tag on it. There's a sort of sense of scarcity and value there, right? And so people start to accumulate it. And tragically, that perception of scarcity actually ends up driving a reality of scarcity for those who are not able to participate in that sort of hoarding mentality.
Is there,
that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So you know, I need to sort of like back up and say, you know, this view, you know, I have the privilege of this view. I live in a agricultural community. I'm surrounded by people who don't have a lot of money but have a lot of wealth of sort of knowledge and skills. And, you know, that's a tremendous privilege.
What is the, I'm curious, what is the social wealth of Hardwick and Cabot and your region up in the edge of the Northeast Kingdom, as it's called? Do you see each other often? Do you have dances and balls? Do you have...
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean,
you know, I think there's a mix. I mean, one of the things that's sort of interesting to me to note, I mean, there is a lot of that going on. In my town, you know, Cabot is a smaller town even than Hardwick. Cabot is a town of about 1,400 people. And we have, I believe at last count, 11 small-scale dairy farms in Cabot. So it's probably the town of, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's more dairy farms per capita in Cabot than any town in North America. You know, it's still very much an agricultural landscape. And the point I guess I want to make, I'm trying to make, is that the people work a lot. So there is. You know, there are times when I wish there were more of those kind of events around here, but I also recognize that a lot of my neighbors, you know, they spend a lot of time working. But there's also what I notice in our community in particular. I'm not really – Hardwick, there's a little more infrastructure for and a little more of that stuff going on, the dances and the contra dances and, you know, theater and whatnot. What I notice here is, in my community, is much less of a distinction between work and leisure. And so, you know, we live equidistant between two dairy farms, small dairy farms, and I get all of the waste milk from these dairy farms to feed our pigs on our little farm. So I see these people, you know, almost every day. And it's a rare day, you know, when I don't stop by the farm and spend 10 or 15 minutes just sort of chatting in a barnyard or in a, you know, in the milk house or whatever. And that's a lot of where at least my personal sort of social interaction happens. I mean, you know, we have friends that we have over for dinner and we have, you know, get the kids together and those kind of play days. But with our immediate neighbors, a lot of that relationship is sort of inserted into their working life, if that makes sense.
What's your farm like and what are you producing and how does that work?
So, yeah, we've got, you know, I get this question a lot, and I sort of describe it as a turn-of-the-century Vermont hill farm, just not the most recent turn of the century. So we have 40 acres. We have about 10 of those are in pasture, and sort of we have three large gardens that probably total almost a quarter acre. We have 100 blueberry plants. Right now we have... five creatures of the bovine persuasion, two milk animals, and a few beef. We usually do, over the course of a year, we might do six or eight pigs. We have some small orchards that we're establishing. We have a wood lot, so we do, you know, we get all of our own firewood. We get saw logs. I have a little sawmill, so we get for building barns and outbuildings and stuff, we are able to pull saw logs.
That's great.
It's a very sort of... Yeah, it's off-grid. We have a quarter-mile driveway, and at the time when we bought the land, we just simply could not afford to have power run back here, so we ended up with a small borrowed solar photovoltaic system, and we have since expanded that in our places. We have never brought power back, so we're off-grid. And so it's a very sort of, if you looked up sort of... bucolic, sustainable, off-grid homestead. You know, our place might pop up. You know, that's kind of what it is.
You mentioned in the book that you were fortunate to marry a girl who didn't absolutely require running water.
Right. Yeah.
How are you guys doing with the running water?
Well, we have running water, and we have had for a while. And we live a very comfortable life. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I've got high-speed internet. We've got lights, and we've got hot running water, and all of these, the primary creature comforts of the 21st century American life. We also happen to use about between 3 and 4 kilowatt hours, consume about between 3 and 4 kilowatt hours of electricity a day, which is, as you may know, just a little bit more than maybe 10% of the average American family of four. I was really fortunate in that Penny, my wife, is just, you know, if anything, she is less interested in the accumulation of material goods and monetary assets. She just has absolutely no interest. When I met her, she was running a community-supported agriculture on a farm, and she's got a tremendous amount of knowledge in terms of just like growing things. She's a worker. The barely kept secret is that, you know, Penny is the one who really gets everything done around here. I'm the one who sort of, I sit up in my office sort of, you know, pontificating on the phone with Jim Kunstler, you know, and it's like, you know, while she's out actually busting her busting her knuckles. That's not entirely true. I'm being suspicious. But, you know, so yeah, I had really good luck, and I chose well. Let's put it that way. And you know, we both, I think, even our personal ethos just continues to evolve in a direction where we're much more interested in our connection with to the land and nature and community than we are in, and we're interested in the safety net that provides, much more so than the safety net of accumulated monetary wealth. We unschool our children, they stay home, and they have tremendous freedom and flexibility to sort of spend their days on the land. You know, it's for someone who is interested in the presumed definition of the high American standard of living, we're probably pretty poor. You know, I guess it's probably obvious by now that that's not really, you know, we don't consider that a very sort of healthy metric for a life well lived.
If there are any woofers out there, worldwide organic, how does that work?
Yeah.
Worldwide,
yeah, organic something farmers.
Yeah.
Right.
These are young people who volunteer to do farm work so that they can learn how to run small ag operations in, you know, a non-industrial way. Do you use them?
You know, that's sort of an evolving conversation around here. We actually, for the first time last year, had someone come and stay on our place for 6 weeks, and it was an absolutely fantastic experience. We were really nervous about it. We have a tremendous degree of sort of privacy and autonomy. And we were sort of nervous about, you know, opening up our family dynamic and our personal lives to that extent, and it was really, really great experience. So I think we're less nervous about it and more willing to consider those options. We are really thinking about what we want to do for the coming summer, because that is a possibility for sure.
Well, I've been speaking to Ben Hewitt, who's the author of First The Town That Food Saved, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food. It's a book about the revival of Hartwick, Vermont, around artisanal farming and secondary value-added activities. And his book coming out in June this year is called Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. So, Ben, I wish you continuing happy adventures in the quasi-non-money world of off-the-grid farming.
Right back at you.
And, well, I'm not off the grid.
You've been listening to the KunstlerCast featuring James Howard Kunstler. Send email to jim@kunstlercast.com. You can interact with other listeners, hear previous episodes, and find out more about this podcast at KunstlerCast.com.